interview with Aaron Aysen of Aysen Law, PLLC. Welcome back to Simple Cyber Defense. In this week's episode, we're going to be interviewing Aaron Aysen of Aysen Law, PLLC. And the topic of choice here is the privacy laws. Now, just a point of disclaimer before we start that this is not in any way legal advice, and this is strictly for informational and educational purposes only. So with that said, I'm Carl.
Hi, this is Ahmad.
And we're going to start with the interview. So, Aaron, thank you for agreeing to come on the show. And
absolutely.
So the first thing is, why don't you give us the quick rundown of who you are and your experiences with cybersecurity and privacy laws in general?
Absolutely. So I've been an attorney now for about 10 years. I've worked a lot in regulatory compliance. And I've done a lot with insurance as well. And in fact, one of the first things I did when I started practicing law was work with a partner to write a paper on cyber insurance. And it really, that was kind of my very first introduction into the space where you see risk management and cyber really start to collide. And cyber insurance back then wasn't new, but it wasn't very widespread at the time. In the last 10 years, I guess since we, well, 9 years since we've written that paper, it's all over the place now, and the industry has changed a lot. So I've done that. I've written a lot on data privacy, cybersecurity, both for businesses and for individuals and families and small businesses. I've helped big companies meet various regulatory requirements, but I've also, tried to also focus a lot on, what can everyday individual, what can individuals and families do to protect themselves? Day when, technology is everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's just, and it's really important to know how to protect yourself when prevent things from happening to begin with, but then also to how do you respond?
Yeah. All right. So with that said, the first question we have is, what are privacy laws in general and why are privacy laws important?
Well, privacy laws in general it's actually a more complicated question than you might think. There's always been this sense in the law of this, I don't want to say always, but at least in recent history, recent memory, of this idea that we have a right to privacy, that we have a right to share the information that we want to with people, and that, they should, there should be certain safeguards with what they do with that information. And one of the things that we've seen, especially in recent years with things like with Facebook and some other companies, is that there's really this market for information. We use Google and Facebook and LinkedIn and all of these, all of this software and these programs all the time. And we kind of take it for granted because it's free. When you log into Google, you don't pay them anything. You can just do a Google search. When you Facebook is free, aside from, extra add-ins and things that you're advertising that you can pay for. But the real price that we are paying, the real cost that we're paying, is that we are giving them lots of information. And that information can then be, and then they sell that information. Have you ever noticed how you type in a Google search and then you go, like, let's say you're looking for camping equipment. I don't know. You're trying to buy some camping equipment. And then you go into Facebook the next day and all of a sudden, oh, wow, you start seeing all of these advertisements for camping equipment. That's how they make their money, is this marketplace of information. And so there's a sense that there is information being spread around. And And some of that is information that we may not necessarily want spread around. Like, you don't want your, you know, maybe your medical information passed around. You don't want your financial information passed around. We're seeing more and more children, excuse me, that are actively involved in an online space, you know, having Facebook accounts and Instagram. And, you know, so these data privacy laws are designed to really kind of do a couple of things. Number one, they're designed to regulate what businesses and organizations generally can do with your data, but it's also, they also kind of lay out the methodology, the recourse that they're supposed to take if and when there's a problem, and, you know, any associated penalties. Mm-hmm. So I guess, yeah. And the problem we have in the United States, though, is that there really isn't a one, is that we're really dealing with a patchwork. You know, you certainly do have federal laws that deal with this. You have HIPAA and HITECH and some of these other laws that deal specifically with your medical information. You have some federal provisions that govern number one, how organizations protect your data. So, for example, the FTC can investigate a company if they are just woefully negligent in putting in sufficient security features into their software, you know, into prevent an inadvertent spread of your information. But at the same time, they're also going after companies who they say, oh, we are taking care of your data, and these are all the steps we're taking, and then you later find out that they weren't doing any of that. Mm-hmm. And then you have a patchwork of state laws. You have laws in California. You have laws in Virginia. There's some new biometric laws in relatively recent biometric laws in Illinois. You have various laws governing your smart, you know, when you drive a car and you know, they say, oh, you just pay for how much you use it. You know, well, insurance companies, you know, so it's really this patchwork of laws, and there's really not a one size fits all, which can kind of make it very difficult for compliance purposes.
Okay. I know you touched a little bit on this, but so basically, what types of privacy laws are there other than the HIPAA and the privacy or the California state laws and the biometric laws? Are there any others that out there? Or just those?
Yes, ones that has really affected the United States, and there's been some movement to try to even out the expectations, I think, a little bit, and to try to make it so that companies have an easier time complying, is the GDPR and all the accompanying regulations and things that go with that. It's probably one of the most stringent. The California laws are probably the closest to that. It's a relatively rigorous regulatory regime in Europe that governs data privacy. It also it becomes a bit of a trick for U.S. companies that do business over there, because even though they may be, let's say, based in, I mean, Facebook is a great example of this. You know, Facebook may be based in California, but you know, it obviously has users over Europe. And so there's the GDPR. There are, again, biometrics is a big area now. You know, when they ask for your fingerprint, or they ask for when they ask for certain, you know, iris scans or whatever, you know, there are certain laws that govern, you know, how long you have, you know.
Sorry, you're cutting out there. What was the last thing you said?
Oh, I just said that there are a lot of the biometrics, for example, governing the use of any biometric data that they make, that a company may collect from you.
Okay. So with that said, are there any privacy laws specifically for minors, or is this just the Wild West for the minors and just protection for the adults?
Oh, there are some, there are some for minors. They aren't as I just want to get the So there are all so the Children's Online Privacy Protection Rule from the Federal Trade Commission that goes out that you know that lays out certain requirements for minors. You know, one of the problems with the protections for minors, I just wanted to make sure I got exactly the name right. You're going to find when you get into data privacy that that there are that there's a whole it's like an alphabet soup of different names. You have the CCP, the CPRA. I think Virginia tried to one up California with their more recent law, and I think they kept it to three letters instead of four letters. But the challenge in today's world right now, and I think we've seen this with recent hearings in Congress, is what were the more intangible? You know, when you see I don't want to say intangible. What do you do with companies that market for children in more indirect ways? So I'm thinking like Instagram. Mm-hmm. Like Instagram is a big thing, you know. And there was a recent dump of information from Facebook, and there were internal documents that showed that Facebook knew about the effects that Instagram was having on minors. And so, in kind of a rare show of bipartisanship, you see it was Senators Blackburn and Blumenthal who were getting together, you know, to craft legislation that would really outline what you could and could not sell to minors. There are obviously other, you know, and you see this all the time. You start seeing this more and more. So you see, are you 18, or are you 13? And when you're logging in, you know, even a game like Pokemon, for example, you know, there's a Pokemon Unite that you know I play with, you know, that I sometimes play with my son, you know. Even that, you know, you have to make sure that you're of a certain age in order to make sure, you know, in order to not the wild, wild west, but I don't think it's nearly as developed as I think it will become given what we saw coming out of Facebook and some of these others. I think, you know, I think one other thing too, Carl, that I think is important to realize is that there also can be very big legal consequences for how children use technology. Because they're still subject to the same laws in many respects that you and I are. So, for example, if your child is bullying somebody online, you know, back in the day, you know, school bullies would, you know, bully you on the playground, but your home could be a refuge. But that's not the case anymore. You know, every single, you know, most kids in high school have a phone. And it's so easy to send around pictures. It's easy to send around, it's easy to, you know, fake pictures, fake photographs online now. It's easy to spread rumors. And, you know, there's really not a safe place for them. But there can be legal consequences for that because, you know, if something happens, you know, the parents can be sued, you know, in cases. You also have a problem of sexting. Youth are exploring their bodies. And, you know, if you have a couple and they start, you know, they choose to send, you know, pictures of themselves. And I apologize for the more mature theme here. But the thing is that it's a real problem because some prosecutors will deem that child pornography and the children can actually get in trouble. Like they can be deemed sex offenders for the rest of their lives because they're sending pictures, you know, of themselves scantily clad or otherwise, you know, around school. And I don't think that, you know, this isn't something that we talk about a whole lot, but it can have very real world consequences for parents, for kids and otherwise.
Okay. So now shifting gears a little bit, would you say that there are any privacy laws specifically in the workplace, or should you just expect to have absolutely no expectation of privacy at work?
I think it depends on what you're talking about here. You know, I think notice is always a big issue. So for example, usually in like employee handbooks and sometimes even on the screen itself, it says, you know, you have no expectation of privacy if you're using a work computer. Mm-hmm. And you may have a, you know, but But then, you know, if you're outside of work talking about work, you know, then that's, you know, or taught, you know, outside of work, I guess it depends on what the situation is and how much it impacts the work that you do.
So I was thinking more like, would an employer be allowed to, like, say, if you have your cell phone connected to a Wi-Fi or even mobile data, would they be able to basically sniff that traffic coming through to see what you're doing on your phone? Or would you have like some kind of expectation of privacy in that state?
Well, employment law is governed a lot by states. So it would really depend on the state that you're in. And I think it would also depend on what was actually going on. Like if you're sitting there and trying to steal company records, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, if you are connected to somebody's Wi-Fi, you know, there's a question about how much privacy you really can expect from that. I mean, if you're using employee resources. So let me give you for example, if you're on a work computer, right? And you're sitting there and taking customer, and you're getting ready to quit, and you're sitting there and taking customer lists and sending them out through your own private email, you know? Now there's a question about, you know, can your workplace do something about that? Well, I think you know, that's one question, you know?
Yeah.
If you're sitting there and attempting to upload a virus into the system using Wi-Fi, you know, or whatever, you know, if you're attempting to connect in with other devices on the network and attempting to upload a virus, well, you know, that's something else too. You know, I think it's really going to depend on the situation. It's going to depend on the state you're in. It's going to depend on a whole lot of factors that, I can tell you what I do. As a general proposition, I do not do personal stuff on work computers. Mm-hmm. I do not connect to my work Wi-Fi. I do not connect to any of that. I try to make it very clear that what I do at work is work, and what I do
personal is personal.
Personal is personal, work is work. Now, I mean, some companies have policies that say that, you know, if it's de minimis use, mm-hmm. you know, so if you're just getting on there to check your email really quickly, you know.
Yeah. And also, the line kind of blurs when you get the bring your own devices, where you have your personal device, but you're also using work with it. So,
yeah, and that's why it's important for employers to really make sure that there's good policies in place, you know, to make sure that there's things like two-factor authentication to make, you know, to really protect the work stuff. I mean, you know, if your phone is just lying around at home, you know, can your kid pick it up and start looking at your work emails, you know?
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things that need to really be taken into account. But I think as a best practice, it's usually good to, as much as you can, to keep,
keep that separation.
Just keep that separation. And plus, I might also add here too, that if you're connecting up with a network at work, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got a virus in there, you know, what's to say that the virus isn't going to, you know, hit your phone?
Jump on that,
vice versa. You may not know you have a virus on your phone, and you could end up, you know, depending on the level of security features that you have or that your workplace has, you know, you may end up inadvertently uploading a virus there. So as a practical matter, I think you just don't do it, but.
Yeah, I agree. We also preach a lot about separation of data so that it'd be harder for it to be cross-contaminated and easy for people just to steal everything from you. So staying in the realm of businesses, do you think the business community is ready for laws like the CCPA on a federal level?
I think they're becoming more comfortable with it.
Okay.
I think there's a general sense that this is coming. Mm-hmm. We don't know when. There have been several attempts to pass legislation in Congress to kind of create a more uniform approach to data breaches and responses and security and And, you know, what can you sell? What can you not sell? And I mean, a big part of this is also disclosures. I mean, that if there was ever an argument to be made for having a federal standard, it would be that you don't want that, you know, if you're a company that operates in all 50 states or you have clients that are customers in all 50 states, you don't have to try to comply with 50 different laws when it comes to, you know, what your privacy notices look like. Mm-hmm. Some privacy notices can be, you know, the law can require them to be extremely detailed. And you're sitting there looking at that going, you know, how in the world am I ever going to understand that? Whereas in some places, you know, the law is a little bit more like, just make sure that it's clear. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever read your terms of service for your iPhone or your, you know, or your or whatever, you know, I mean, those things can run pages long and it's just like,
or even Facebook's.
It's just, it's insane, you know? Yeah. I once heard Chief Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States, say that he didn't even read the terms of service for his iPhone or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think there's a sense that they're coming. But I also think that there's I think companies are going to struggle with how do you do this in a cost-effective way.
Okay.
But this can get very expensive, and I still, you know, a friend of mine once described the relationship between your chief information officer, your chief technology officer, and like the CEO and the board is a kind of a thermocline of truth. You know, the CEO really, you know, there's money makers at a business and there's money consumers. And I, especially in this area of security, can be really more of a money. I think it's ransomware attacks increase and other things. It's, I think more businesses are taking note of the world that we live in and are at least the extent they can trying to find ways.
Okay. So say for example, the businesses are ready. Do you think that the consumers would be ready at this point, or do you think they would need more education to be more comfortable with these types of laws? Or do you think they won't be affected at all?
No. To the extent that the consumers need to be educated, I mean, that's part of the reason for the privacy notices. Mm-hmm. You know, like in California, there's, you know, you can opt out, you know, there's certain, you know, you're supposed to be part of the process. Identifying to the business, you know, can you sell my data? Can you not sell my data? There's, you know, what happens when there's a data breach? What are my rights and, you know, what are my rights? What are my obligations, you know, in the event of a data breach? So I think I think that there is certainly more education that can take place, because I don't think that we fully appreciate sometimes just how dangerous the world can be from a technology perspective. Hackers and wrongdoers are very good at the human psychology. You know, they understand what makes us tick. They understand that if you get an email at 6 o'clock in the morning as you're just waking up that says, you know, if you don't, you know, click on this link and provide this information, provide your username and password right away, you know, your account is going to be frozen. You're probably not going to sit there and, you know,
what was that last sentence?
Oh, I just said that you're probably not going to think a whole lot, you know, if you're just going to click on that link because you don't want your money to be frozen. You know, I mean, there's a reason why these Nigeria scams are so successful. They're extremely successful and for a very good reason.
Yeah,
I think more education is always good.
So. And hence the reason for this podcast is to educate everyone. So do you think that we are building a global privacy capabilities for a regulatory future? Or do you think that that's just a pipe dream that we're all going to be in our little separate pods? And
I think there's movement in that direction. Like I said, there's been a lot of work between the US government and the EU and others to try to come up with a more uniform way for, you know, to come up with uniform systems for approaching data privacy. Mm-hmm. But I still think we have a ways to go. I think that, you know, in the United States, we're kind of an interesting place because we love our freedom, but at the same time, that freedom, you know, that freedom does come with a bit of a price. You know, that, you know, if you have more freedom, then you, less regulation, then you're kind of relying on the goodwill and good intentions and best efforts of the person next to you, which may or may not be true. You know, and so I think that there's certainly a recognition that there is a problem. I just don't know that I think we're moving in that direction, but I don't think we're there yet.
Okay. So how would you say, are there any ways that we could encourage the building of the privacy and data ethics into new technologies, or are we just bound to legislators who don't really understand and just hope for the best?
Well, a big part of technology and an organization's use of that technology is the reputation of that organization with the data. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen companies like Facebook and some of these others that have actually lost consumers. You know, there seems to be this trend that, you know, some bad news comes out about Facebook and they tend to lose. And I'm not trying to pick on Facebook here, but I'm just saying that there's a reputational risk that comes with how you go about dealing with people's data. I mean, if you're, you know, I'll give you an example. If your doctor's office is constantly leaking health records, you know, how long are they going to stay in business? Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, most cyber attacks, as a general proposition, generally happen to small to mid-sized businesses because they're really, at the end of the day, the low-hanging fruit on the tree. It's just that most of the big ones that you hear about are the ones like Target, Yahoo. Mm-hmm. And even today, there were some by Apple and I think it was Facebook, where, you know, some doers were, you know, basically forged law enforcement requests in order to get certain information from the company. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones you tend to hear about, but most attacks happening in small and mid-sized businesses. I mean, I certainly would hope in a perfect world that businesses would do that. But like I said, you know, businesses are constantly caught in this tension between making money and spending money.
Yeah.
Think about all the big ransomware attacks that we've recently seen. Mm-hmm. And we know where a lot, I mean, they're coming from Russia, in Iran, North Korea, China, and a bunch of these places. And, you know, so the question becomes, you know, do you pay the $10 million? Do you pay the $20 million or whatever it might be, knowing where that money is going to go and what that money is going to be used for? You know, is it going to only encourage them to do it again? But at the same time, you know, if you're running a Fortune 500 or a Fortune 100 business, do you really want to just shut down the business? You know, really just you could categorize the ransom as just the cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm. Which a lot of people are doing.
Yeah. So these are just tough questions and tough decisions that these CEOs and others have to make. Do I think that Congress will eventually come around? I think they will. How good will the law be? Well, that's another question entirely. there are some serious points of contention about, you know, what should be in such a law. Some of it has to do with, you know, what are the recourses and what are the, you know, for people. It just kind of depends on where you're at. But I think there's a general consensus something needs to be done. I think they just can't agree.
Okay. All right, so the final question we have here is, from a legal perspective, what can I do after I've been hacked?
So it depends on the hack. If we're talking about, let's just use a setup. Okay. Let's suppose that, you have gotten a, let's say you've gotten one of those emails where it's from your bank and they say, if you don't put in your username and password right away, you know, we're going to freeze your funds, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, as part of that, you need to put in your social security number and you need to put in your birthday or just other basic PII, personal identifiable information. So once that information is gone, it's gone. And that's just the way it is. It'll probably be sold and moved around. The best thing you can do is, number one, get new credit cards or new debit cards. Notify your banks, notify your financial institutions. If your credit accounts aren't locked, lock them right away. You can go to each of the TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian and get on there and learn how to lock your credit accounts. What that does is that prevents somebody from, let's say, going out and opening a Best Buy credit card in your name. Or going out and trying to take out a mortgage in your name or whatever it might be. So that's critical, is, you know, put up a blockade against that, realizing that they may not try to do it right away. You know, this stuff can be, you know, dormant, you know, they steal your data and it's sitting there in the dark web or wherever it might be. And years. So I'm actually a fan of keeping your credit reports locked, period. All the time, and not because you just don't know, you know, how long it's been out there, and you don't know where they may have gotten it from. So contacting your banks, locking your credit reports, filing a police report is always a good idea. Filing a report with the FTC is always a good idea, the Federal Trade Commission. And here's the reason for that. If you are, let's say that somebody opens up a credit card in your name, it ends up, let's say, going to collections. And I actually had a case like this, where somebody was hacked. There was identity theft. They opened a credit card in my client's name. And then when he didn't refuse to pay it because he didn't know that it was open, he ended up getting sued. And it went and it caused all sorts of problems. And the reason why we were able to get him out of it is because he had done all of those things. We could show it to the bank and whoever, you know, look, he was a victim of identity theft. Here is the, you know, here's the police report. Here's the FTC report. Here's all these documents that show that he was the victim of identity theft. And so they decided to just drop it. And they may not always drop it, but at least, you know, it gives you a much better case.
Sorry, you're cutting out again. What was that last sentence?
Oh, I said, I'm really sorry. I don't know why my mic is not here. I apologize. I was just saying that it goes a long way to proving that you are not the person, you know, that you're not responsible for it. And, you know, it can help you get out of a jam, a financial jam.
So, Ahmed, if there's anything else you want to add in?
No, I think we covered everything pretty good.
All right. So with that said, thank you again, Aaron, for agreeing to come on here. And remember that this is not legal advice. This is just for informational and educational purposes only. And we look forward to the next episode. And if you have any suggestions or topics or anything, leave them in the comments or go to simplecyberdefense.com and hit on the topics tab to leave any suggestions of topics that you want us to cover. And with that said, we're going to close this one out and say goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Simple Cyber Defense Security Updates. Join us next time when we dive into more security issues and make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. Plus, if you have a topic suggestion or want to support the podcast, stop by our website at simplecyberdefense.com.